We really don't know much about the details of his life, but around AD 150, a boy named Clement was born to a pagan family, probably in Athens. We're not sure where and when he accepted the Christian faith, but we do know that once converted, he wanted to learn that faith from the very best of teachers. So, he did what high school graduates today still do. He moved away from home in search of the best education. His quest led him far and wide until he came to the place where he should have started. This was the city the Greek conqueror of Egypt so humbly named after himself, Alexandria. This conqueror, by the way, though he lived 300 years before Christ, is a reason that the New Testament was written in Greek. Alexander had a goal of uniting the world through the spread of Greek culture, and he was wildly successful. From his time forward, the common language and culture of the whole Mediterranean world was Greek. The Roman conquest did not change this. In fact, the Romans simply co-opted the Greek gods, the Greek classics, and Greek philosophy. The sign on the cross over Jesus' head was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek because, outside of Italy and North Africa, Latin was only used in the government and the army. In the marketplace and in the schools, people communicated mainly in Greek. When Clement arrived in Alexandria, it was one of the largest and most vibrant cities in the world, second only to Rome. Located on the sea at the mouth of the Nile, it was unrivaled as a center of trade. Its lighthouse was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was also the intellectual capital of the empire with a legendary library. A large Jewish community lived in this city, where the Hebrew Bible had been translated into Greek for the first time. Christians had been there since New Testament times, and among them, Clement found the teacher he'd been long looking for. Pantinus was a convert to Christianity from the Stoic school of philosophy. We don't know much more about him except that, though he was a layman, he had a very important role in the Christian community. Evidently, the local bishop had put him in charge of the very first Christian school in history, a catechetical institute where new Christians were prepared for baptism. Clement soon became his assistant, and around AD 200, he became Pantinus' successor. The church in Alexandria had evidently enjoyed a respite from persecution for some time. Nonetheless, it was now menaced by heretical sects of every stripe. The main Gnostic groups that prompted Irenaeus' book had headquarters here. Gnostic ideas were in the air. So were the ideas of Plato and the Stoics. Many Christians evidently reacted by shunning any sort of pagan learning and withdrawing into a sort of intellectual ghetto. Clement himself notes this. The multitude are scared of Greek philosophy as children are of masks, fearing that it will lead them astray. He goes on to say that, like the companions of Odysseus, passing the sirens, they stop their ears because they know that if they once allow themselves to listen to Greek learning, they will not be able afterwards to find their way home again. In another place, he describes the negative and defensive posture he observes on the part of many of his brethren. I am well aware of what is said by some who stupidly take fright at any noise. They assert that one must concern oneself only with what is necessary and is bound up with faith, that we ought to pass by anything outside this as superfluous because it distracts us to no purpose and absorbs our energies in studies which are of no help towards our ultimate end. There are others who even think that philosophy was introduced into human life by some evil inventor for the ruin of men. As a faithful disciple of Christ and son of the church, Clement is, of course, critical of the Gnostics and aware of the limitations of philosophy. But as someone entrusted with evangelizing and training new inquirers, many of whom were cultured members of the upper classes, he saw this unqualified rejection of learning as nothing short of disastrous. It played right into the hands of those who ridicule Christianity as having no rational basis whatsoever. Just a few years before he took over as head of the school, a pagan critic of Christianity by the name of Celsus had written that while there may be a few cultured Christians, the majority say, "Do not ask questions, only believe. Faith will save you. Wisdom is an evil thing and foolishness good." Galen, a famous physician and philosopher of the day, made much the same observation. Clement saw knowledge of philosophy and literature not only as important for outreach to cultured inquirers, but as tools for defense of the faith. The Hellenic philosophy does not, by its approach, make the truth more powerful, but by rendering powerless the assault of sophistry against it and frustrating the treacherous plots laid against the truth, is said to be the proper fence and wall of the vineyard. Part of philosophy is logic, and in the face of often irrational and baseless attacks, Christians need to know how to use it. Above all, Clement is a man of scripture and tradition. But evidently, secular learning had prepared him to accept the gospel as it had for Pantinus and Justin. So he advances significantly beyond Justin, who had seen seeds of the word present throughout the pagan intellectual world. Clement goes so far to say that Greek philosophy is actually of divine origin. Though philosophy is not on a par with the Old Testament, God, in his providence, sent it to the Greeks as a preparation for the gospel, in a similar way that God sent the law and prophets to the Jews to prepare them for his son. Granted, Greek philosophy neither comprehends the truth in its entirety nor conveys the strength to fulfill the Lord's command. Yet, it at least prepares the way for Christianity by making a man self-controlled, by molding his character, by making him ready to receive the truth. Clement had to fight the same foes as Irenaeus, but he employed a different strategy. He refused to ridicule his Gnostic and pagan critics. Instead, he aimed to steal their fire. The word Gnostic means the person in the know, who possesses saving knowledge. Baptism in the early church was called the Illumination. Clement maintains that the real Gnostic, the true enlightened one, is the person who receives the light of faith in baptism and is determined to penetrate the profound meaning of that faith by making use of every available aid. Living out this faith, growing daily in virtue as well as understanding, the Christian Gnostic attains love and ultimately heaven. Around the year Clement arrived in Alexandria, Irenaeus had written, "The glory of God is man fully alive." In his book called The Stromates, Clement sought to sketch what man fully alive looks like, and he called him the true Gnostic. Clement wants both his catechumens and his pagan critics to understand something. The true Christian life does not consist in simply accepting the deposit of the faith, getting baptized, and then attending the required services. On the contrary, this just begins a process of ever-deepening insight and sanctification. For the knowledge that Clement is talking about consists not only of intellectual understanding, but of an intimate experience of God and His truth that leads to a transforming union. It is a knowledge that assimilates us to God and to the truth that we contemplate. This, therefore, is the life work of the perfected Gnostic, namely, to hold communion with God through the great high priest, being made like the Lord as far as may be. And in being thus assimilated to God, the Gnostic is making and fashioning himself and also forming those who hear him. As he goes about describing the journey of the true Gnostic, we learn much of the features of Christian life of the day. Clement does not want his people to go mindlessly through the motions of prayer or to fast out of mere custom. Rather, he wants them to do everything intentionally, aware of the deeper meaning of their external actions. For example, it was already a part of Christian tradition to pray facing east. Clement directs the Christian Gnostic to do this, but to have understanding of its meaning. And since the east symbolizes the day of birth, and it is from thence that the light spreads after it has first shone forth out of darkness, aye, and from thence that the day of the knowledge of the truth dawned, like the sun upon those who were lying in ignorance, therefore our prayers are directed toward the rise of dawn. The Didache told us that Christians are to fast on Wednesdays and Fridays. But Clement wants the Christian Gnostic to understand the reason for this. The Gnostic understands, too, the hidden meanings of the fasting of these days, I mean of Wednesday and Friday, for the one is dedicated to Hermes, the other to Aphrodite. At any rate, he makes his life a fast, both from love of money and love of pleasure, which are the springs of all the vices. Aphrodite also known as Venus, was a goddess of love, Hermes, the goddess of fortune, chance, thieves, and gain in general. We see also, as we did in the Didache, that Christians have set times of prayer, including the Sunday Eucharist and the prayer three times per day, specified by the Didache. The Christian Gnostic observes these fixed times, but would never just leave it at that. Following St. Paul's counsel in Philippians 4, his goal is to pray always, maintaining a continual conversation with God. Accordingly, all our life is a festival. Being persuaded that God is everywhere present on all sides, we praise Him as we till the ground, we sing hymns as we sail the sea, we feel His inspiration in all that we do. And the Gnostic enjoys a still closer intimacy with God, being at once serious and cheerful in everything, serious owing to his thoughts being turned toward heaven, and cheerful as he reckons up the blessings with which God has enriched our human life. Clement likens the life of the Christian Gnostic to a life of spiritual training. So in every difficulty, the soul of the Gnostic proves its strength, being in first-rate condition and vigor, like the body of the athlete. Plato had said that good is diffusive of itself. Clement sees that the crowning act of charity in the life of the Gnostic is to share his knowledge with others. Certainly, sharing perishable goods with those in need is part of the lifestyle of the Gnostic. But if the duty to share earthly things is a solemn one, even more so is the duty to share heavenly truth. It is a duty, but it is the greatest joy of the Gnostic as well. Clement may be director of the catechetical school, but all authentic Gnostics, all Christians who desire perfection, must be evangelists and catechists. Heretical Gnostics were elitists and kept their knowledge a secret. The true Gnostic shares that truth with anyone and everyone. But the dignity of the Christian Gnostic is carried to an even further pitch by him who has undertaken the direction of the teaching of others, assuming the management in word and deed of that which is the greatest blessing on earth, by virtue of which he becomes a mediator to bring about a close union and fellowship with God. Teaching others for Clement is a matter of both word and deed. Both Ignatius and Justin poured their energies into teaching by the spoken and written word, yet their ultimate witness was the laying down of their lives. For Clement, living in a period of relative peace, teaching must be accompanied by the white martyrdom of a life of virtue dedicated to Christian perfection. Despite the sensuality of pagan society at this time, the more philosophically minded held sexual abstinence in high esteem and wondered whether a true philosophic life could be carried out amidst the cares that accompany a spouse and children. Marcion, whose heretical church had branches in Alexandria and all over the empire, totally rejected marriage as cooperation in evil. The evil demiurge had commanded, "Be fruitful and multiply," and the last thing Marcion wanted to do was encourage anyone to help this fiend carry out his wicked plan of entrapping even more souls in the muck of matter. Clement found it necessary to counter these errors with a defense of marriage. In doing so, he made an early and invaluable contribution to the Christian theology of marriage and family. For Clement, marriage and procreation are not only permitted, or even, as the Stoics taught, a duty to society. Rather, we are in the presence of something more than natural and good. Marriage is truly something sacred. In becoming parents, man and woman have communion with God in His creative work. Thus, man becomes an image of God insofar as man cooperates in the creation of man. Clement appreciated both celibacy and marriage, seeing each person as receiving their particular calling and gift from God, but he did not mind sharing his opinion on which is a higher calling. Unlike the other fathers who weigh in on the subject, he voted for marriage due to the opportunities it provides for self-denial and the testing of virtue. True manhood is shown not in the choice of a celibate life. On the contrary, the prize in the contest of men is won by him who has trained himself in the discharge of the duties of husband and father, and by the supervision of a household, regardless of pleasure and pain. By him, I say, who, in the midst of his solicitude for his family, shows himself inseparable from the love of God, and rises superior to every temptation which assails him, through children and wife and servants and possessions. On the other hand, he who has no family is in most respects untried. Clement did not hold that procreation is the only reason for matrimony. The intimate sharing of all things and the mutual support between spouses is something that is most precious in Christian marriage. The virtue of man and woman is the same, for if the God of both is one, the master of both is also one. One church, one temperance, one modesty. Their food is common, marriage an equal yoke, respiration, sight, hearing, knowledge, hope, obedience, love all alike. And those whose life is common have common graces and a common salvation. Common to them are love and training. In the Christian family, the Lord himself is present. Subsequent church fathers would develop this theme that the family is the domestic church. But we find the idea suggested in the beautiful way that Clement interprets a familiar saying of Jesus. But who are the two or three gathered in the name of Christ in whose midst the Lord is? Does he not by the three mean husband, wife, and child? For a wife is bound to her husband by God. This, of course, is not the only gospel text Clement cites. Although Clement wrote only a few years after the appearance of Irenaeus's book, we know that Clement, like Irenaeus, recognizes, quote, the four gospels that have been handed down to us, unquote. Following Irenaeus, Clement cites from nearly every book of what came to be known as the New Testament. In total, in the course of the four works of his that have come down to us, he cites passages from the New Testament 2,000 times, texts from the Old Testament over 1,500 times, and Greek classics over 360 times. Writing two centuries later, St. Jerome calls Clement the most learned of all the early fathers. Of course, Justin had been the explorer who made the initial contact between the divine wisdom of the gospel and the philosophy of the Greeks. But Clement was the pioneer who settled down, cleared the stumps, and planted a garden in the field of Christian philosophy, a garden that yielded much fruit. The famous patristic scholar Johannes Quasten says of Clement, "We owe it above all to him if scholarly thinking and research are recognized in the church. He proved that the faith and philosophy, gospel and secular learning, are not enemies but belong together." One could only imagine what more Clement could have accomplished had he had more time to cultivate his garden. But his tenure at the catechetical school was cut unexpectedly short. Seemingly out of nowhere in AD 202, a fierce persecution erupted in Alexandria under the Emperor Septimius Severus. The catechetical school shut its doors, and Clement fled the country. He was never again to return to his beloved Alexandria before departing in AD 215 for his heavenly homeland.